Chances are, if you subscribe to my podcast, then you're probably one of the many across America who was frustrated with the way Hillary Clinton's presidential run was covered in the mainstream media. If you're a woman and/or a member of a marginalized group, you viscerally felt and saw the double standards and sexism doled out by the majority of the mainstream press. Coverage of her policies fell to the wayside in preference to scandal and clickbait controversies. We know from 2016 postmortem election coverage analysis, this wasn't all in our head. According to Columbia Journalism Review, in just 6 days, the New York Times ran as many cover stories about Hillary Clinton's emails as they did about all policy issues combined in the 70 days leading up to the election. If you're anything like me, you're still processing that while dealing with a double-edged blow of seeing the mainstream media make the same missteps in coverage with the current female presidential candidates this election cycle. The double standards and the sexism are back, along with racist tropes. Last week, I began to pull back the curtain on our current coverage. I mentioned the Storybench article titled, "Women on the 2020 Campaign Trail Are Being Treated More Negatively in the Media." Storybench is a news outlet of Northeastern University's School of Journalism. They have since updated their analysis from 130 articles to 1,397 articles, further illustrating their point that female candidates running for president are consistently being described in the media more negatively than their male counterparts. According to their data, Booker, Buttigieg, Sanders, and Beto are all being written about more positively than the female candidates, Harris, Warren, Klobuchar, and Gillibrand. I asked Alexander Franzen, who analyzed some of the data for Storybench, what he saw as a negative pattern when the press is covering women. He said, "While I'm no expert on this, as Meredith Conroy, a professor at CSU Bernardino, is actually the one who pointed this research out to me. But it seems that women generally don't receive as much policy coverage as their male counterpart. Instead, the media gets much more interested in covering their personalities or their controversies. This is something we really saw with Hillary last election. What this seems to do is reinforce ideas about gender by testing whether women are fit to be leaders, while male candidates don't have to prove themselves quite as much." I touched on this double standard last week with Clark University's Dr. Valerie Sperling. She said, "If Hillary Clinton had said even one of the things that Trump had said during the election, it would have immediately been disqualifying. She would have been painted as unhinged. She would have been out of the race. I think the fact is women candidates have to be very careful and very measured in what they say. So women are restrained. And maybe some of that comes across as cautious or calculated, but it's a result of women being aware that the margins of their acceptable behavior are very narrow. Men are allowed a lot of latitude in what they say, whereas women have to be careful to be pleasing and likable. They have to be tough, but not too tough, or else they're threatening and they're come off as a ball buster or whatever. So when women are walking this incredibly fine line, they probably aren't being fully authentic." Along with that gendered coverage, the media seems to craft a script for each candidate, one that is often repeated throughout the media, for better or worse. I want to understand why the media seems to distill each candidate into simplified scripts, which might start grounded in reality, but then seem to take on mythical proportions. If you're lucky, like Pete Buttigieg, it can work out well for you.
A Rhodes Scholar. He was born in 1982. Making him the youngest person running for president this year.
For a guy who's only 37, Pete Buttigieg boasts an impressive resume. A Harvard-educated Rhodes Scholar.
Would be a president of firsts. The first to be elected in his 30s. The first millennial.
A very intelligent guy. You know, he went to Harvard. He was a Rhodes Scholar.
While I'll mostly focus on the female candidates in this episode, all of whom went to prestigious universities themselves and have law degrees, I'd like to quickly interject that Cory Booker was also a Rhodes Scholar and went to Yale Law School, and Julian Castro also went to Harvard Law. and none of them have gotten the same amount of press attention for their educational achievements as Pete Buttigieg, but I digress. Anyway, a good script from the press can help you fundraise, help you rise in the polls. But what if you're unlucky in how the press defines you? For example, Amy Klobuchar and the Combs story that circulated through the press like wildfire.
The New York Times today has reported an anecdote about Senator Amy Klobuchar involving her eating a salad with a hair comb and requiring a staffer to clean it. Think about the nicknames that might spawn.
Even though Amy Klobuchar has been a United States Senator from Minnesota since 2007, is currently a ranking member of the Senate Rules Committee, and was a county attorney in Minnesota for over 10 years, this story attempted to frame her as the mean boss. While there are many witnesses to Trump's bad behavior, from yelling at staff, or where he reportedly was so mad about the Pelosi-Schumer meeting that he stormed out of the Oval Office, throwing items across the room. No one cared about that. They cared about Klobuchar because a bad temperament on a woman, it isn't feminine. Therefore, it somehow hurts her leadership abilities, somehow? I don't know. Klobuchar, along with Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Elizabeth Warren, are far and away more qualified to be commander-in-chief than our current POTUS and the majority of men running. But that Combs story defined the beginning of her campaign. It harmed her polling numbers and fundraising.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
I've looked behind the curtain of traditional media, and like the Wizard of Oz, it's not very diverse. It's majoritatively run by white men painting women as good witches or bad.
I don't believe you.
No, I'm afraid it's true. There's no other wizard except me.
You humbug!
Yeah.
Yes, it's exactly so. I'm a humbug.
Oh, you're a very bad man.
Yes, he is. Now, I want to look at the media's playbook. I want to know why the media crafts or goes with a script. I want to know how the media influences our elections, their biases, and their game framing of political news and media coverage. Luckily, I got to speak with Dr. Regina Lawrence, director of the Agora Journalism Center at the School of Journalism and Communication at the University of Oregon, who is a nationally recognized expert in political communication. She has written two outstanding books, Hillary Clinton's Race for the White House, Gender Politics and the Media on the Campaign Trail, and When the Press Fails, Political Power and the News Media from Iraq to Katrina. Take a listen.
I'm Regina Lawrence, and I'm a professor in the School of Journalism and Communication at the University of Oregon.
What drew you to your occupation?
You know, I've always been fascinated by power. I've always been fascinated by the ways that people or organizations or institutions can convince or make other people do what they would like. And I'm interested in the array of power, everything from, you know, the physical force that police can use, with the authority of the state backing them. But I'm also especially interested in the power of the media because they have the ability to shape how we think about things, which will then potentially shape the choices that we think that we need to make and how we think about those choices.
And what early obstacles did you have with your career?
You know, I don't think I had any that were any different than so many young scholars have. And I think now it's so much harder for young scholars because the expectations around research, productivity, and publication have increased so much. So for me, I was very fortunate to have a wonderful mentor and to have a support network of senior scholars. And it made all the difference in my career. So I actually feel very fortunate and privileged that I really didn't face huge obstacles as a young scholar.
What's one of the misunderstandings people have about your job?
I think that many times people, of course, think that professors spend most of our time professing in the classroom. And we certainly do a lot of that. But there are also big expectations for us and our careers really hinge on our research productivity, how much we publish, and the depth and the rigor of our research. And then there's also a lot that we do with and for students that goes outside of the classroom as well. A lot of mentoring and helping of students that doesn't happen just, you know, within the walls of the classroom.
That makes sense. That makes sense. I have found with academics, people think that their job ends at the end of the semester.
Yes.
And that you're usually working that, you know, the entire time, you know, full time all year round. So
it's so true.
So one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is I had read an interview that you did for your school. And one of the reasons I want to talk to you is because of that. I loved the article because you guys kind of broke down aspects of the press and how they cover presidential elections. And the other reason is because a lot of us were incredibly hurt and frustrated by the way Hillary Clinton was covered by the press. It's something that a lot of us are still processing. And we've started to see similar trends in how the press talks about female candidates versus the male candidates. And I know you wrote a book about that as well.
Yeah.
So, and before we kind of touch on that, I'd like to kind of touch on some of the things you talked about in this article called Six Ways the Media Influences Our Elections. And I'll be referring to this article throughout the interview. I'd like to start with horse race or game framing coverage. You know, what is that? And why does the media, as you said, tend to see election coverage through the prism of competition?
It's a good question. And there's lots of research that shows that the predominant way that the media, and by the way, when we're talking about media here, let's keep an eye on when we're talking about sort of traditional and legacy media, such as newspapers and broadcast news versus newer forms, right? But when we're talking about the traditional media in particular, there's lots of research that shows that the predominant way that elections get covered are through this prism of what we call the horse race, which is sort of paying attention to who's pulling ahead, who's falling behind among the field of candidates, or game framed coverage, which is the tendency of the press to focus on who's up, who's down, who's ahead in the polls, who's behind in the polls, who's winning the money race, who's losing in the money race. So it's a very poll driven style of coverage.
And what was the purpose originally for that, to create excitement? I'm not sure what purpose it served.
Yeah, well, it's a great question because it's not necessarily the only way elections could be covered. It's not necessarily the best way that they could be covered, but it has a couple of attractions for journalists. One is that it simplifies, right? It's a simple format that you can use to look at a field of candidates, and that's particularly attractive when you've got a field like we have this year of, what is it, we're up to 19 now that Biden has gotten into the race, I think. So,
yeah,
or 20, I've lost track. When you've got that many candidates to cover, it can be a simplifying frame for journalists and for news organizations that have to figure out who to cover and how to cover them. So it has that virtue or that attraction, if you will. Also, it does lend itself to kind of easily dramatized storytelling, right? It's kind of a built-in narrative of conflict and competition. And then thirdly, really, it has an attraction for mainstream journalists anyway, because it's a way of staying, quote-unquote, objective. It's a way of staying nonpartisan. You're sort of like a sportscaster, right? And you're just calling the game. You're talking about who's doing well and who's not doing well, ostensibly without bringing any partisanship to it, just like a sportscaster would, right? So it has that attraction as well for journalists who are still concerned about appearing nonpartisan.
Right. Now, I'll circle back to that. But first, there was something that I was very interested in that you said. You said the media tends to perpetuate character-based scripts. And you talk about scripts a lot in your book, When the Media Fails. Yes. You talk about scripts that are given from the powerful, but you're also talking about scripts that they assign people who are running for office. For example, during the 2000 election, you talk about the script for Al Gore, that he was a pompous bore, I remember that. And the script for George W. Bush was that he wasn't very smart, something that kind of carried throughout his years in office. Can you expound upon that, why these scripts are kind of given? And, you know, I know that they did that for the 2016 election as well, but why does the media take it upon themselves to cast these folks running for office into characters, into some sort of archetype?
Yeah, good question. And it's something that my co-author and I, Melody Rose, wrote about quite a bit in our book about Hillary Clinton's 2008 campaign. And then I think we saw many of the same dynamics play out in her 2016 bid for the presidency, right, where, you know, she especially has this script kind of firmly, you know, latched around her neck, so to speak, that she is deceitful, that she's manipulative, that she's controlling, that she's cold. And the thing about these scripts is that they usually do have some basis in fact and reality, right? They're not invented out of whole cloth. The problem with script-based reporting is that, you know, the old saying, once you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. The way scripts work, and this is true psychologically speaking, it's not just in journalism, it's true for us as human beings, that once we begin to think we see a pattern, then we have a tendency to fit new pieces of data, new pieces of information into that pattern. So it's just a human tendency as part of why it happens. Again, for journalists, it's also a simplifying way of covering what can be a very complex set of stories in a presidential election. What I became really fascinated in 2016, and I've been looking at some, doing some additional research on it with another co-author, is the way that the script around Trump in 2016 was largely that he was a buffoon, that he was a joke, that he was a walking punchline. And what that obscured was the fact that for enough Americans, he was a quite credible and very compelling candidate. And that this turned out to be a deadly serious presidential campaign. And the way that that he was covered quite often led people, I think, to just see him as something that could be kind of dismissed, right? That shouldn't be taken seriously.
I remember when he went down the stairs here in New York at his Trump Tower, and I remember watching Rachel Maddow. And I remember her kind of joking about it. And I love Rachel Maddow, but she was kind of joking about it because in New York City, a lot of actors got a casting gig to go there to pretend to be fans of his. So right off the bat, they weren't taking it seriously. So
And again, I mean, I just want to follow up on that quickly because my point is not, you know, boy, journalists, you were so stupid to cover it that way. I mean, the fact is there was a lot of reason to dismiss him. Many political scientists, myself included, were dismissing him as well. But the problem that you know, lent itself to is that a lot of us didn't wake up to the realities of what was driving his campaign until, you know, very late in the game.
Yeah, and I will mention this too. Ta-Nehisi Coates was talking about, it's kind of like when Susan Faludi did Backlash. Ta-Nehisi Coates was talking about how he just underestimated the resentment that people would have about a black man being in charge and that a woman would come next. You know, he said he underestimated some of those things that were frustrating people. And also like this economic anxiety was pushed and all these different circumstances. But I think a lot of us didn't see it. I think a lot of us were blindsided. So I will say the press and the public, a lot of us were blindsided. I will say the Pew Research I was looking at from 2018 said 2/3 of U.S. adults get their news on social media sites. 1 in 5 get their news there often. How have you seen social media change how the media delivers content in the way people consume coverage?
It's been really profound. I had an opportunity in 2012 to travel to New Hampshire and to South Carolina and observe how reporters were covering the different campaign events of the Republican candidates, because, of course, in that election, it was a Republican field that was wide and large, and journalists were trying to cover all of these different candidacies. And that was the election when Twitter really became kind of the central nervous system for campaign reporting. So since then, it's been fascinating to see how now Twitter is fully established as a way that reporters go about doing their job. And now, of course, we know the way that many voters are getting their media, their campaign coverage, if you will, is as much directly from the candidates and the campaigns and different commentators, et cetera, via social media. And so it's become a crazy complex campaign environment, right? So it has been interesting. And some of the things that myself and other scholars have been watching and kind of concerned about is the way that Twitter, again, has some virtues and some attractions for sure. And it also encourages more, on the one hand, kind of more humor and sarcasm and snark. And the fact is journalists are often quite funny people and quite insightful in their humor.
Right.
Excuse me. And it also, of course, encourages a more opinionated take on politics. I mean, Twitter especially is just a very opinionated place, right? So I've been fascinated to watch how that might be changing journalistic norms around, how you cover campaigns, how you talk about the candidates.
I've seen journalists get more personal in how they feel about someone in particular. I've seen, and I think that it's like you said, I think some people are amused by it. And I see that some people are really frustrated to see a journalist kind of talk about their personal opinion about something, especially if it doesn't go with how that person is feeling about the candidate.
Right.
So I've seen that happen. And I think the other part for me with social media is that it's an echo chamber. I mean, you're getting your news of the folks that you're following. So you're not really getting kind of a diversity of opinion. It's a little bit different. It's like the left is fighting each other and the right is fighting each other. You know,
I think that's right. And I think one of the beauties of Twitter as it was originally constructed anyway, is that you can construct for yourself a Twitter that is quite diverse. That's the beauty of it. I mean, there isn't any one Twitter out there, right? There's the Twitter that you construct in terms of who you follow. So I think many people use it in a pretty smart way, right? They curate the folks that they follow pretty carefully to get expertise, to get a range of views, to get diversity of perspectives. But it is true that for many people, they don't necessarily do that. And then it really does become an echo chamber. So I think that that's true.
Well, speaking of which, you discussed in that that UO article about selective exposure, where an audience is seeking out news that doesn't fundamentally challenge what they believe in this world. Is that driving our media polarization, you know, feeding the audience what they want, what they crave, and maybe capitalizing off that?
Absolutely. When it comes to cable news in particular, and of course it's a problem on social media too, as we discussed, I do think it's important to remember that that's not the model for traditional or mainstream news. They are still trying to figure out how to appeal to a broad audience. They're still trying to figure out how to maintain trust and credibility in a less partisan way. And that's really a huge challenge if you're a mainstream newspaper, for example. And especially if you're a newspaper in a local community or a metropolitan area, you've got to figure out how to continue to be relevant and trusted, relevant for and trusted by a pretty diverse community. And that's a big challenge for them. But it's absolutely true that for the cable news in particular, and Fox really perfected this, the business model and the journalistic model is around appealing to one side of the aisle.
Something, a reporter did something interesting yesterday to try to let more people, more of the public, have an opinion. His name is Matt Pierce. He's for the LA Times, and he's going to be covering the 2020 presidential campaign for the LA Times. And he said that he wanted to try something different. He asked all of us on Twitter how we think he should cover the race. And he offered a spreadsheet for the public to give their opinion, which I thought was quite interesting. Should the public have more input in how the media is doing coverage?
It's a great question, and I was so glad you asked it because I had missed his tweet about that yesterday. So I went and took his little survey where he's trying to get a sense
of
what right, of what his followers really want to see in the campaign coverage. And I tweeted it out myself then to say, wow, imagine that, reporters actually just talking to people about what they want to learn about the candidates and about the election. I think it's really important that he's trying this experiment, and I'll be watching it closely. You know, the research in political communication has suggested for a long time that what people really want, or at least what they say they really want, is more serious and substantive coverage, and that they actually don't want all the horse race coverage. That for most right. people, that's really not that interesting because most of us aren't political junkies. But on the other hand, and you could see this right in Matt Pearce's survey, on the other hand, there's evidence to suggest that what we actually click on, what we actually read and listen to and pay attention to, is more of the conflict-based stories, the competitive stories, the stories about influence and manipulation, and, you know, how candidates are trying to persuade voters. So he built that right into his survey, which I thought was great. He asked, first of all, you know, what would you like me to cover? Should we focus more on policy? Should we focus more on the horse race? And then he asked a second question, which said, now, okay, be honest, what are you really going to read if we produce it? So I'll be watching this really closely. It'll be fascinating to see, because it could be that all of that research suggesting that people want something more serious doesn't hold up if we don't actually consume it.
It doesn't hold up once given the option. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
One of the things that I found really interesting in When the Press Fails is you talk a lot about the trust that we have in our media, and how it parallels a little bit to how we have trust in our leadership. And according to the last Gallup poll conducted, the public perception of mass media was an uptick from 2016, but it was an all-time low in 2016. So 45% of Americans have a great deal or fair amount of trust in mass media to report the news fully, accurately, and fairly. You know, there has been an uptick. Why do you think, though, that more than half of U.S. adults still distrust mass media?
That's a great question. And of course, so it's a complicated question. I'm glad you asked it, because on one hand, the downward trend in trust in media is something that's been going on literally for decades, since the late 1960s, early 1970s. Along with, in tandem with, declining trust in other institutions right. of government in particular. So you've got this backdrop of overall declining public trust in the institutions of public life, of civic life. But then you've got this intensified dynamic that really picked up around the 2016 election. So right. I think what's been interesting to see is that it kind of hit a low point around 2016, public trust. And as you mentioned, there's a Gallup poll from a year or so ago that suggested that only 32% of people said that they had, you know, some trust at least in yeah. the mainstream media. And then there's been this interesting little rebound in the last couple of years where there seems to be an uptick in trust. And the interesting thing there is to ask, is that a Trump effect?
Right.
Because the data that I've seen anyway suggests that that's a very polarized uptick. And mm-hmm. what's happened is that trust has not climbed among Republicans. People who identify as conservatives and Republicans are as distrustful as ever in mainstream media. But right. what you've seen is that for people on the more liberal Democratic side of the aisle, they see major news institutions like the Washington Post and the New York Times, et cetera, you know, continually investigating and pressing on the Trump administration, and also are probably reacting against Trump's attacks on the media,
right?
And so we've got this sort of polarized increasing trust, if you will, that's really only happening on one side of the aisle.
And that makes sense, too, because we're needing our fourth estate to kind of help us, you know, hold him accountable, especially when the Democrats didn't have the House and didn't have the Senate. You know, we need somebody. One of the things that I'm very interested in is that you talked about self-perpetuation. So something that will happen, like Pete Buttigieg, who was relatively unknown at the beginning of the presidential cycle, you know, reports came out that he was a happily married gay man. He had served in the military. And then when the press learned he spoke several languages, was a Harvard grad, was a Rhodes Scholar, they just couldn't get enough of him. And I remember listening to Andrea Mitchell say, he speaks several languages. And then that ricocheted, and I heard it on another news program within the hour. Wow. You know? And it was bizarre. It was a little bit of an echo chamber. They were saying the same things over and over again. And so he climbed in the poll. His fundraising went through the roof. He became a media darling. But other candidates with similar backgrounds, like Julian Castro, really languished in the media. And the coverage of women went downhill. 538 is keeping track of how many mentions each person gets every week, which I like, actually.
Yeah.
Sanders almost got 1,000 mentions last week. Pete got half of that, and the women were much less than that. Why is the media not – I don't know if they are realizing that they are helping with this self-perpetuating cycle by elevating name recognition, by giving them more print, that they're – that automatically they're kind of being the kingmakers. You know, why is this happening as opposed to vetting them?
It's a great question. And the example that you gave with Buttigieg is just the latest example of a dynamic that we've seen in presidential campaign coverage, again, for decades. Mm-hmm. It's been really well documented. There's a great book by Thomas Patterson, a leading political communication scholar at Harvard. And he wrote his book, I think it came out in 1984, called Out of Order, that looked at how the press covers presidential campaigns and found this dynamic, this pattern, where you get a kind of almost a quick-moving and sometimes ephemeral or shifting focus on, oh, there's this candidate, this person seems to be leaning ahead, pulling ahead, and this person has all the momentary fascination of the media, right? So it's been a long-standing pattern. I think in order to understand it, first of all, we can go back and remind ourselves that complexity of covering a crowded field of candidates, that it's pretty tough for news organizations to figure out how to divvy up their resources, and their resources are more limited than ever in terms of time and budgets for covering campaigns. So how are they going to do that really equitably? That's a challenge under the best of circumstances, right? And then you introduce things like social media and the very fast moving news cycle that we're in now. And there's tremendous pressure to sort of jump on that bandwagon. If there's a lot of attention going toward one candidate, you don't necessarily want to be the news outlet that's not paying attention to that candidate, right? So, and you're right, it can be problematic because not only because these candidates rise very quickly in attention and kind of suck the oxygen out of the room for everybody else, they can also fall pretty quickly. And sometimes based on kind of circumstantial or superficial sorts of things. One example that you might recall in an earlier election was Howard Dean and the famous scream, right? And I think that happened in Iowa right after the caucuses there. And it goes back to that script-based reporting that we talked about as well. In that case, because reporters were already sort of pinning the script to Howard Dean that maybe he wasn't quite ready for the national spotlight, and then there was that problematic moment where he seemed to really scream very loudly, almost inappropriately in front of an audience, even though people who were there said it was just a campaign event. There was nothing unusual about it. But for reporters, it became this kind of this defining moment is something we talk about in the Hillary Clinton book. It's this defining moment that seems to show like, aha, see, he really isn't ready. And so these moments can happen that can really shift the dynamic for individual candidates. You know, it's probably coming for Pete Buttigieg pretty soon that, you know, there's going to be some defining moment for him that's going to knock him off stride and shift the dynamic of the news coverage towards somebody else.
That makes sense. Now, I know you got to go soon. So do you have time for two more questions?
I absolutely do. I'm enjoying this conversation so much.
Good. I just want to make sure that I'm not rushing you off. One of the things that a lot of us have been talking about online and on Twitter is the diversity or lack of diversity in media.
Yeah.
And, I was going through the Women's Media Center's 2018 report on women of color in media. And so 83% 2.2% of our journalists are white, 70% of them are white men, and Black women and women of color only make up about 7.95% of the newsrooms, 12% of local TV stations, and 6% of radio newsrooms. Is the lack of media diversity the reason that maybe some of them are unable to see some issues intersectionally? And how is the lack of diversity affecting our news coverage?
It's a great question. I mean, the simple answer is yes, absolutely. Lack of diversity in the newsroom is a huge challenge because it means that there aren't people there to necessarily bring a different perspective as decisions are getting made about how to cover things. Absolutely. I think the other question to ask is sort of, it's not just that, for example, white reporters would be completely unable to see or to recognize, you know, intersectionality right. issues in their coverage, but kind of what's the impetus, right? If nobody's in the room to raise the question, whether that person be of color themselves or just simply, you know, really aware of those issues, if nobody's raising the question and pushing it, then it's likely to not get considered in the rush toward deadlines, in the difficult environment of trying to figure out, again, who to cover, how to cover them. It's so much easier to go with standard approaches and standard scripts and standard routines. And so we really do need people throughout the newsrooms that are really challenging existing ways of telling stories about elections.
I had a conversation with Jonathan Allen, and we talked about it on Twitter together, he and I, and he said something that I was frustrated with online. He talked about how much money Kamala had raised versus Pete Buttigieg. And I kind of, when I had a conversation with him, he didn't realize that he wasn't seeing the historical factors in the fact that a Black woman raised $12 million in a presidential election. He was just judging it towards what Pete made. And it was interesting to me that it didn't occur to him. And Jonathan knows I talk about this. He's okay with it. It wasn't a private conversation. But he did apologize. And he just said it's just something that didn't occur to him. So that's one of the reasons why I worry about it, because I feel like in newsrooms, maybe they're not challenging each other to kind of see these things from different angles or to see the historical significance of this. And I feel like with Hillary Clinton, it was like this double-edged sword with her. It was kind of like, oh, she can't use the woman card, but it's also important that she is a woman. Like, you know, we saw the Republicans using that against her. Like, she's just using the woman card. Mm-hmm. Or we saw Bernie's people saying, well, I'm not going to vote for her just because she's a woman. Mm-hmm. So we saw it was very gendered. So we know that gender politics played a role in this last election. Are you seeing similar things play out that way with gender politics in this election with the women, now that more women are running now?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's so many layers. This is one of those problems that social scientists might describe as kind of overdetermined. There's so many factors pushing toward a particular outcome that we have to kind of disentangle that a little bit to think clearly about it. So you've got, on the one hand, you've got eons deep gendered attitudes about women in leadership, right? Very deeply ingrained cultural pattern of seeing women and leadership, particularly executive leadership, as somehow incompatible, right? That those two things just don't go together. So you've got that. And then on the other hand, again, you've got the dynamics of news coverage, the complexity of covering elections, and therefore the need that newsrooms feel for just some sort of tried and true, if you will, ways of approaching elections. And you put those two things together, and as you point out, it means that a really phenomenal candidate in terms of just potential and background and profile and all of that, like Kamala Harris, can kind of get lost in the mix, right? Because if she's not pulling ahead by the traditional measures, which are the opinion polls and the money race, then she's not likely to get as much attention. I mean, again, the tried and true approach for many newsrooms that seems nonpartisan is to say, we're going to pay the most attention to the candidates that seem to already be pulling ahead, the logic being that they are the ones that the public's most interested in. And of course, the problem with that that formula, that calculation, as you point out, is that the media themselves are playing a big role in that dynamic, right? The media right. themselves, by deciding whom to cover more, can accentuate that pattern, can accelerate that pattern that one candidate begins to really pull ahead. So it's a huge challenge for women candidates, for minority candidates. And so, of course, for a candidate like Kamala Harris, it's a really significant challenge that she's facing, absolutely.
I have two last questions for you. Last podcast, I spoke with Dr. Valerie Sperling from Clark University. We talked about an article from Storybench where they found, after analyzing 130 articles from mainstream media, that female candidates were consistently being described more negatively than their male counterparts. And one of the ways that she recommended this change for the media is that they could start reading Rebecca Traster's Good and Mad. Mm-hmm. How do you think the media, the mainstream media, could start changing or start being aware of how they are discussing female candidates? I mean, one of the issues that I see is a lot of the times I think they think they're treating them equally. Like, I think we saw that a lot with Trump and Clinton. They thought, wow, we're being hard on both of them. But they weren't seeing how theirs with her was coming out much more sexist. What do you think the media could do to start making some improvements on how they're covering these candidates?
Yeah, and by the way, your observation about 2016 is absolutely true. The research really bears this out, that Trump and Clinton got almost precisely the same level of coverage and the same level of negative coverage in particular. And somehow for many in the media, that seemed like, okay, well, we've done our jobs, right? Because we've right. been equally negative toward both. And of course, the type of negativity that each candidate was exposed to is very different. So with Clinton, it was really this kind of focused, again, script-based narrative that turned a lot on emails and, you know, Benghazi and these kinds of storylines that fed into the script about her being manipulative, deceitful, etc. So that's a whole, right. we could have like an entire episode just about that dynamic. In yeah. terms of what reporters can do, one thing that I've seen happening recently in the last few years, which I think is exciting, is that some journalists and newsrooms have really started paying close attention. They've started analyzing their own coverage to say, for example, right. wait a minute, how many female sources did we interview for a story? Mm. Have we, you know, when we're covering a story about science or social science, how many experts who were women did we interview versus male experts? There's a wonderful kind of Twitter effort called Women Also Know Stuff. That's women academics who are kind of constantly reminding the media, like, hey, we're here. We have a lot of expertise and things to share. So I think one way is that if they actually take a hard and rigorous look at their own coverage, not just right. sort of like, oh, no, we did that in the story over here, but rather, no, take a big sample of your own coverage and really look at it. Of course, right. they could also read some social science, which would, you know, again, show these patterns. And then I think, yeah. Like you suggest, reading Rebecca Traister's book would be fantastic, a favorite of mine, even though it's older now, but it's still just so full of insights, is a book by Kathleen Hall Jamieson, who's at the University of Pennsylvania at the Annenberg School. Right. She wrote a book many years ago called The Double Bind, and it was about women in leadership, in politics and beyond. And again, the kind of deeply ingrained gendered attitudes that women have fought against and worked their way around literally for centuries. And I think, you know, just becoming more aware of the subtle ways that gendered attitudes and gendered language can work their way into your coverage, into the stories that you're writing, just becoming more aware of that is so important.
That makes sense. So I will end with this question because, you know, I love the media. I don't want people to think. Right. I know that they're under constant scrutiny. Yes. I'm so thankful that they're there. And I, you know, I worry all the time with how Trump talks about them. Mm-hmm. He really is putting people's lives in danger. So I want to know how we as a public can be respectful of the media and hold them accountable for biases in coverage at the same time.
It's a wonderful question. I'm glad you asked it. I think it is important, especially this day and age where it feels like things have become so uncivil and so polarized, that we try to treat institutions with respect, or at least with an open mind, right? And give them the benefit of the doubt that they are trying to do a good job. But of course, at the same time, respect is earned. And there is a moment here. There's a pretty important moment, I think, happening because of that low point in public trust that was captured in the polls in 2016 and 2017 and 2018, that now news organizations are kind of hyper aware of this problem of public trust. It's a big problem for them. It's a problem for them journalistically. It's a problem for them economically. It's an existential problem for them. So I do think you see many journalists, many news outlets really trying to figure out new ways to reconnect with the communities that they serve. So it is a moment also for the public, for us as news consumers, to read widely and to listen broadly and with as much of an open mind as we can muster. And then also to push back when we see coverage that we think isn't adequate, that is in some ways biased, or like we were talking about, that contains these gendered attitudes, racial attitudes, et cetera. I think there's a new openness in many news outlets to really listening to that feedback from the public. And of course, there's new mechanisms for us to do that. There's the comment sections, there's social media, there's many reporters now are really trying to listen more closely to their readers, their audiences. And so I think they listen more and more carefully now than they did even a decade ago.
Thank you for listening. I'm Maya Contreras, and this is Obscene.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.